Bonsoir et bienvenue. J'ai le grand plaisir et l'honneur de présenter Madame Govinda Bhamra, qui est professeure de sociologie historique, donc ce qu'on appelle en anglais historical sociology, un domaine qui n'existe pas en tant que tel, pas le label. Bon, il y a des gens qui le pratiquent, mais le label là, sociologie historique. Et qui travaille sur, en fait, la modernité, toute la question de la modernité, le post-colonialisme, les interactions, les chevauchements entre le fait d'un monde qui est à la fois très mélangé avec la mixité d'une part et le fait que la modernité n'est définie que par rapport aux critères européens. Donc, Govinda, en fait, en 2007, avait publié un livre qui s'appelait Rethinking Modernity, Postcolonialism and the Sociological Imagination. Et où elle a un peu mis en avant, exprimé ses thèses et surtout sa façon de concevoir la modernité comme étant un concept plutôt connecté que la façon dont la plupart des historiens ou sociologues l'ont vu, soit comme une unité fixe ou bien en termes des multiples modernités, c'est-à-dire autant d'expressions qu'il y ait de culture et de façon de voir, tandis que pour elle, c'est quelque chose qui est beaucoup plus connecté, où l'idée même de la modernité est née à partir des interactions et des connexions, où en fait, justement, c'est une des raisons pour lesquelles je pensais que même par rapport à la question de Brexit, dont elle va nous parler aujourd'hui, que cette idée est aussi vue dans le même esprit de connexion que de demander à Sanjay Subramaniam de répondre et d'engager une discussion autour de cette idée.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for inviting me to do this seminar. I'm very pleased to do it, particularly on the theme of Brexit, which is very much at the forefront of my mind and maybe of yours as well at the moment, given that we'll be announcing the intention to leave on Wednesday. So, and then 2 years from there, Britain will unlikely be part of the European Union. So apologies also, I'm speaking in English. I'm afraid I don't speak French, but if there's anything that I'm saying that you want me to repeat or to say, just let me know. So just to start, I mean, the UK referendum on continued membership of the European Union, it's been presented as being a referendum on whether we remained part of the EU or whether we left the EU. But in a sense, the debates that occurred during in the lead up to the referendum, it was much less about the European Union. And as I'll argue, it was much more a conversation that happened about race and migration. Specifically, who belonged and who didn't, who had rights and who didn't, and maybe who should have rights and who shouldn't. I mean, one of the key slogans during the whole campaign was we want our country back. And this led to particular ideas of sovereignty, and I will suggest that there were very specific racialized discourses that were at play during this period. The issue in part that I want to pick up on here is that the populism that marked the political debates that were happening within the public sphere were mirrored within the social scientific discourse. So in the same way that we had a turn to sort of a very particular type of populism that was promoted by the media, by politicians and so on, social scientists and academics were not exempt from using the same sorts of concepts if couched in a different sort of language, and partly I'll during the talk unpick some of those. But before starting, I just want to lay out some facts, and facts are always up for interpretation, so we can discuss those facts in the discussion afterwards as well. But just to set the context for what Brexit was and how it came about. David Cameron, who was then the Prime Minister of Britain, decided to call a referendum on the European Union. Not because there was mass movements in the streets who desperately wanted a referendum on whether we stayed part of the EU or not. That was absolutely not the case. The only reason for calling the referendum was because he wished to try and settle an argument that had been going on in the Conservative Party for the last few decades on European Union membership. He thought he would win. He didn't think for a moment that he would lose. He thought it was a safe referendum to call. And so it was really to try and settle an argument in the Conservative Party that this referendum was called. He lost, and we're now having to live with the consequences of that loss. Now, for a referendum to have such serious constitutional repercussions, usually, the usual form in most countries is that you set up some rules at the outset. For example, that the turnout should be 75% and that there ought to be a two-thirds majority in the thing. Again, because Cameron didn't think that he would ever lose this referendum, and in order not to have protracted arguments with politicians and so on about setting the terms of the referendum, he just went for a simple referendum. Whoever turned out, whatever the victory was, so long as it was 50.1%, that would be a victory. And so it was set up without any thought whatsoever. Now, much has been made in the media and political discourse about how the vote to leave has been a vote of the white working class, those who've been left behind through the processes of globalization, that this was a cry against the sort of processes that have gone on that have left people out, and it was really a kick against the establishment. I mean, when you've got two billionaires running each side of the campaign, it's not quite clear who the anti-establishment candidate would be, but nonetheless, that's the key message that has been presented both by politicians and within the media, is that this is something, that this is a cry that we need to listen to because it comes out of the legitimate grievances of the left behind working class. But if we look at the data of Brexit, the data suggests a rather different story, that it's not really about the white working class, but that it's something rather different. So it's incredibly difficult to provide a robust analysis of the data, in part because we don't have the data. So again, because it was never believed that Leave was going to win, the whole setup for the referendum was done on a different sort of basis. So the usual constituencies that would have formed the basis of aggregating data during normal elections weren't used. Different constituencies were used, such that you couldn't make any sort of connections between the data from the EU referendum and compare it to other elections and so on. So that was impossible to do. The only data that we have are from what's called the Lord Ashcroft polls. He's somebody who runs a polling company, and on the day of the referendum, him and his team interviewed about 12,000 people across the country, and they weighted it for gender and race and so on. So the only robust data that we have is this, which is 12,000 people. But before I just go to that, just to give you the bare facts. So the referendum turnout was 71.8%. So again, if it had been set up according to most things, it wouldn't have met the threshold. Leave won by 51.9% against Remain, which was 48.1%. So that's not even a 4% difference. England, so if we think about the different nations, England voted by a margin of 53.4% to leave. Wales also backed leave, getting 52.5%. Northern Ireland, however, voted remain at 55.8%, and Scotland voted remain at 62%. So there's a different voting patterns that we can see in terms of the different nations that make up Britain. And also, if we take the total electorate, the Leave vote was 37% of the total electorate. So in a sense, what is now being presented as the absolute will of the people, that's something that is no longer up for discussion, something that is now just set in stone, was voted for by 37% of the electorate. In terms of the data that we've got from the polls, there's no distinction in gender terms. So the same number of men and women voted both for Leave and for Remain. Where the differences come in are around age, particularly. So those who were retired voted in the main to leave. Over 50% of those with private pensions voted to leave, and over 66% of those on state pensions voted to leave. Those who own their own houses, 55% voted to leave, and white people voted 53% to leave. Tory voters, it was about 58%. And with the Labour and Scottish National Party, their vote to leave was only about 36 to 37%. So the vote was very much driven by a Tory constituency, those who own their own homes. And the other reason why age is significant is because more older people are registered to vote and they voted in greater proportions. So even though the demographics may be different, younger people were more likely to vote to remain, but they were less likely to have registered to vote in the first place and less likely to have gone out to vote, even if they had been registered. So the profile was skewed by who went out to vote. This was particularly true or of consequence within London and Scotland, because even though both London and Scotland had very high remain voting, they also had the highest abstentions. So more people who could have voted didn't vote in both Scotland and London. And some of the analysis suggests that if London and Scotland had voted at the same rates as everybody else in the country, then we would have remained and not left. So that was a really significant figure. And then one other statistic to give you is that the BME, which is the British term for black and minority ethnic vote to remain, was between 67% for Asian voters, 73% for black voters, and 70% for Muslim voters to remain. So there's a clear distinction between the white population who vote predominantly to leave at 53% and the BME community, which votes between two-thirds to 70% to remain. And we can talk about the differences there, particularly in the context of this issue of the left behind, because on all national data, the left behind would also include BME populations economically, but they're not the populations who are voting to leave. And so how does that distinction, which is effectively a racialized distinction, play out? Within all of this, I mean, Danny Dorling is one of the people who has done quite a lot of work on the numbers. And he argues also that 13 million registered voters didn't vote and 7 million eligible adults were not registered. And out of that 7 million, they were disproportionately young, flat dwellers, renters, and members of ethnic minorities. So again, the populations that would have been most likely to vote remain were not registered. And in part, this is a consequence of legislation that the Conservative and Liberal Democrat government brought in the last government, which made it much harder for people to be registered to vote. So there's a systematic process of disenfranchisement that's going on in Britain, which takes the vote away from people. Danny Dorling also provides a bit more analysis suggesting that of all the people who voted to leave, 59% were in the middle classes, A, B, or C1, as he presents it. And the proportion of leave voters in the lowest two social classes was just 24%. And this is again skewed because the middle class were more likely to vote. So two-thirds of the people who voted were middle class, and the middle class was much more likely to vote leave. And so that also. So in summary, on the data that we have, the vote to leave was determined by propertied, pensioned, well-off, white, middle-class voters. It wasn't the left behind. It wasn't the people who had nothing to lose. Or rather, those who voted really had nothing to lose because they were secure in what they had, and Brexit wouldn't make a difference to the quality of their life subsequently. So having given you the data, I now want to sort of go in and think how we might interpret both the discourses that went on before Brexit and to think about the ways in which the arguments were made and what gave them their plausibility at the time. If you followed the referendum at all, you would have known that in the last few weeks, particularly just before the vote happened, it was marked by an increasingly toxic discourse on citizenship and belonging and rights. And this discourse provided at least part of the context for the brutal killing of the MP, Joe Cox, who's the person who killed her. When he went up into court and had to give his name, he was asked to provide his name for the court, and he said his name was Britain First, Death to Traitors. So there's a sense in which this sort of language that occurred during this time was part of created an atmosphere that led very directly to the killing of Joe Cox. And after the referendum, there was a massive increase in the number of xenophobic and racist attacks and incidents that happened across the UK, with a Polish man being killed in Essex, as well as a number of other violent attacks. And also, the language of public discourse changed, or people heard statements and words in public that I don't think they'd heard since the 1970s. And so Put Britain First became a call that resounded not just from Batley and Spen, where Joe Cox was murdered, but in various degrees of intensity up and down the country. And it was also mobilised in media and social scientific accounts, which sought to focus attention on what was called the plight of the white, and here they're talking specifically, I think, of the English working class. Paul Mason, who's a sort of left-wing journalist, wrote in The Guardian, and I quote, "What happens when, instead of Poles, it is poor white English people herded into the polytunnels of Kent to pick strawberries for union-busting gangmasters?" Now, the prioritisation of poor white English people over presumably poor white Polish people points to an analysis of class that's deeply racialised, and it's one that marks most of the debates that happened on Brexit. And I think racialising the working class in the context of debates that seek to take our country back really play into a problematic discourse about who has rights and whose quality of life should take priority within public policy. But it also works with a misguided sense of who we are and how we came to be. And so within the whole debate, there was this constant thing about we want to take our country back. We want sovereignty over our country. And there was this idea that somehow Britain was a nation state. The UK was a nation. And yet, if we look at the history of Britain, I would argue that Britain's never been a nation. From the very first moment that Britain comes into being, which is 1707, with the union of the kingdoms of England and Scotland, both England and Scotland already have colonies. In becoming a united kingdom, they continue to have colonies. So Britain is always an imperial state, not a national state. And so in that sense, Britain has never been a nation. It's been empire from 1707 till 1948, when it transfers empire into Commonwealth, and then in 1973 it joins the European Union and becomes part of a transnational federation. So this idea of wishing to go back to some point is to go back to an imperial past, but couching it within the language of a national historiography, which has never actually has no empirical reference point. So while there's been no independent Britain, no island nation, what there has been is a racially stratified political formation that Britain led to its own advantage. And the rancour that seems to mark the Brexit debate seems to stem more from this loss of privileged positioning, based as it was on white elites and a working class that was offered the opportunity to see itself as better than the darker subjects of empire. What I've called in other terms, the hierarchies of class and caste embodied in the hierarchies of race. And what I want to argue is that there is no way to understand Britain or the British separately from empire or from the imperial modes of governance that have remained dominant well into the 20th century. In the immediate post-war period, for example, Britain explicitly refused to consider itself a nation and maintained empire and the Commonwealth as its key political imaginaries. So there's never been a sense of Britain as a nation in its presentation of itself until very recently, and that comes about as a consequence of the politics of our time. Now, whilst I would argue that there is a much longer history within which to situate the arguments I wish to make, what I'll do in the presentation today is really to set out these arguments in the context of decolonization, because it's the post-war period and the way in which decolonization begins to shape a sense of what it is to be British that I think is really significant. And one of the reasons why I think Britons and British historians and sociologists haven't really dealt with it. I mean, it was interesting. There was just an article in the Financial Times today talking about the fact that because Britain won the war, or decolonization occurs at the same time as the post-war period in which Britain presents itself as having won a war. So the presentation of that victory enables it to ignore the processes of decolonization for its own social psychology, if you want to put it in those terms. And so in a sense, I want to bring decolonization much more central and think about the way in which understandings of British citizenship emerge in the post-war period. I mean, I ask people, we have historians here, and so you may know the answer to this already. My students or other people I've spoken to very rarely have. When did Britain establish a form of citizenship that was only for the British, i.e. related only to the UK? Does anybody have an idea? What, 1940s? Possibly? Anybody else?
I would imagine it's later than that.
1981. Yeah. So it's not until 1981 that you have a form of British citizenship that refers only and directly, predominantly, to the UK. And it's not until 1948 that Britain even thinks to legislate for an understanding. So you're right, you know, that's the first time that Britain begins to think about citizenship. But at that point, as I'll go on to talk about, it's in the context of empire. So debates on British citizenship only emerge within Britain in the 1940s, and it's not till 81 that there's a legal statute that specifies British citizenship as a category distinct from the earlier forms. Now, disentangling, so it's that period that I'm really interested in, from 48 to 81, and to think about the ways in which British citizenship is established in this period. But just to say a little bit about citizenship initially, because most social scientists who work on citizenship think about it as something that emerges in relation to the nation. And then the question is, how do we include others into citizenship? So if we think about the debates in the present around migration, refugees, and so on, the more progressive of those debates are oriented to how do we make migrants into citizens? You know, turning strangers into citizens is another way it's being presented. And Rogers Brubaker, one of the key theorists on this, has talked about the way in which citizenship, that there's two ideal type versions of the way in which citizenship is associated to the nation. There's the French version, which is the originary modern nation state, where conceptions of nationhood and citizenship cohere around an idea of political unity. Or then the other is the idea of the nation state as ethne, as exemplified by the unification of Germany in 1871. Where citizenship is understood as derivative of ethnic and cultural unity. In each of these cases, however, Brubaker and other social scientists tend to elide empire as significant in terms of its relation to the construction of national political community. Now, in the previous talks that I've done during my time in Paris, I've looked both at the way in which both France and Germany were imperial states at the moment of becoming national states, and how imperial imaginaries have been central to the formation of understandings of citizenship both in France and in Germany, but have been elided from the discussions of citizenship in the present. Britain is presented by Brubaker as a case that falls somewhere between the other two. So he sees Britain as a composite state, or a state that's made up of composite nations, and there's an obstacle to the development of a full national feeling because of that. And he also goes on to talk about empire to some extent in the British context, but only in terms of how British citizenship comes into being as empire fades away into the background. Now, whilst I agree that British citizenship only comes about as a consequence of decolonisation, I think the processes of decolonisation are much more significant to the development of citizenship. It's not as if empire just disappears and British citizenship emerges, but the two are interlinked quite substantially in terms of determining their particular formations. So the shift from empire to Commonwealth to European Union is significant in all sorts of accounts of how we might think about British political community. And in a part because what links these phenomena, and now the aspect of Brexit, is that the way in which British citizenship is configured is through the practice of taking rights away from citizens. So as we can see in terms of what's happening at the moment in the British context, even in the few years leading up to the very referendum, one of the key debates was how what were termed EU migrants ought not to have the same rights as UK nationals within Britain. This was in terms of benefit, particularly child benefit ought not to be paid, you know, all these sorts of things. So there's been a process of a gradual taking away of rights, which I will argue actually stems from the period of decolonisation. And just to put this into context in terms of thinking about the point at which Britain enters the EU, so in the period in the early 70s, late 60s, when Britain is negotiating to join the European Union, just want to make it clear that there was not one line of discussion within Hansard, which is the record of debates that happen in the House of Commons. There's not one line which expresses any concern about immigration from the European continent to Britain. That's not even considered. The only thing that's going on in the House of Commons at the time in terms of immigration is concerns about Commonwealth immigration. And so Britain joins the EU in part to deal with the problem of Commonwealth immigration, and then in the arguments for Brexit, pretends to wish to return to Commonwealth in order to stop EU migration. So you see that there's a very circular logic to the debates that are going on. But let's have a look then at how citizenship comes into being. It's in 1948 that the British Nationality Act is established, and this act makes everybody within Britain and its dominions and its colonies, both former and continuing, to be understood as British subjects. Sorry, up until 48, everybody was a British subject. From 48, they're now designated as Commonwealth citizens. So this is to everybody in Britain, everybody in the Dominions, and the Dominions are Australia, Canada, New Zealand, South Africa, and the colonies, they were all Commonwealth citizens. Now, the impetus for the British Nationality Act was not because the populations within Britain were arguing we want citizenship. That wasn't really the reason for this coming about. Rather, it was the fact that India becomes independent in 1947. The Dominion countries had been arguing for greater political freedom for organising their own affairs from the sort of 30s onwards. And in part, it was specifically about in terms of regulating immigration. So Canada and Australia had wished to establish whites-only immigration policies, which they did in the 1930s. Britain at that time had been very concerned about this because the imagination was of an empire in which everybody was free to move and circulate and so on, and so hadn't wished to establish bars on immigration due to colour. And so Australia and Canada argue for greater autonomy in order precisely to have a different immigration policy within their country, within those parts of the empire, than anywhere else. By the 1940s, both Australia and Canada are making greater bids for freedom or to run the settler colony in their own terms. And India is now free. And so, and all of these, and partly the political debates that are going on within those places, are centred around ideas of citizenship. So interestingly, India delineates a sense of what it is to be an Indian citizen before Britain establishes what it is to be a British citizen. So in 48, when Britain finally sets out the British Nationality Act, where subjects are now to be understood as Commonwealth citizens, there were four categories of citizenship. Two of them are significant for our terms. First was citizen of the United Kingdom and colonies. So that's one category of citizenship, United Kingdom and colonies. There was no distinction of being a UK citizen or a citizen of the UK colonies. It was all one shared citizenship. The second one was citizens of independent Commonwealth countries. So that is all countries that had ever been dominions or colonies that chose to remain within the Commonwealth had now Commonwealth citizenship. That gave them rights to enter Britain, to live in Britain, to work in Britain, and so on. So at the moment, in 1948, formal citizenship was given to the entire population of the former British Empire, which some people have put at around 800 million people. Now, I think it's interesting that the first moment at which the government sought to clarify what British citizenship meant, people in the colonies were formally stated to share that citizenship with people in Britain. Now, part of the explanation for this is that there was a strong ideological commitment to the old Commonwealth, and in particular the fact that these countries were central to Britain's foreign and economic policy. To be a global power, Britain had to have its colonies. It wasn't a global power without those colonies. But as the subsequent debates over citizenship would illustrate, the issue of immigration became much more serious to internally, you know. So in the immediate post-war period, there was still a strong commitment to empire, to Commonwealth as part of the process of creating Britain as a global power, and this gradually shifts, in part because of decolonization of other parts of the British Empire. So just because India and Pakistan become independent in 1947 doesn't mean that Britain doesn't still have a significant empire. It still has many colonies in Africa and in other places. And it's only with their gradual decolonization over the 1960s that Britain begins to focus more on itself and then begin to think about joining the European Union as a way of not having to deal with the loss of status that no longer being an empire would have meant. So then we come to the question of thinking about these citizens in the context of Britain. So 1948 is the year of the establishment of the British Nationality Act. But it's also the year that the Empire Windrush docks at Tilbury Docks in the Thames. And this is the name of a ship that brings 500 West Indians carrying British passports into Britain. Now, the realities of empire means that movement of people is not unusual. People move. Often they moved through forcible systems of enslavement and systems of bonded labour, but they also move in other sorts of ways, and British and Europeans more generally colonised most of the world through migration. So what was it about Windrush, which again was just an aspect of subjects stroke citizens moving around the circuits of empire? What made it significant was the fact that this was one of the first instances where collectively the darker citizens of empire were exercising their rights to move freely and legally, as many of their paler compatriots had been doing throughout history. As James Hampshire argues, the movement of people was a movement of citizens within an imperial polity rather than a movement of aliens to a sovereign territory. So this wasn't migration. People weren't crossing political boundaries in their movements. They were traveling within the same polity. And so it should have been no different than somebody moving from York to London than from moving from the West Indies to London. But it was seen to be significant, particularly in terms of the mythology of the changing face of Britain. And it's these mythologies that I think have taken on a renewed and toxic political vibrancy in light of Brexit. So when people, many British sociologists and historians tell the history of Britain, they talk about multiculturalism as something that comes about in the 1960s, partly as a consequence of Empire Windrush, but also the increased movement of people from parts of the former Commonwealth or former colonies and now Commonwealth, into Britain. But Britain had itself understood its empire as a multicultural entity, in the sense that it acknowledged the linguistic and cultural diversity that constitutes empire. And so multiculturalism may take on a particular normative, become a particular sort of normative project in the period, in the post-war period in Britain, but as an empirical description, it's a description of empire over the previous 200-300 years. Albeit that the diversity that was present was hierarchically organized around ideas of racial difference. And it's this particular idea of racial difference that comes to define British citizenship over the following decades. Now, while, as I was saying earlier, Britain had initially rejected this idea of defining citizenship in terms of race, over the sort of 50s and 60s, increasing debates occur within Parliament around this particular idea. So how does it begin to happen? I mean, it's incredibly difficult for the government to do this, because what begins to happen is that once everybody's been given citizenship, some people, not everybody, not 800 million, but some, decide to move to Britain. As increasing numbers begin to move to Britain, there's a sense of, oh, I know we said that you were all equal and you all could move to Britain, but we don't actually like the fact that you're coming to Britain, and particularly if you look different to us. So we want to stop you, but Britain's in a quandary because it can't. Because it's given citizenship and this is a legal act, it can't just simply take away citizenship from some populations as much as it might like to. And so there's a huge amount of... And partly it can't, because it still has colonies. So if it was to take citizenship away from some, it would have problems in places where it still had authority and rule, and so it's just too complicated to do this. And so what people decide to do is start thinking about, okay, well, we can't take citizenship away from people, but we don't really care whether they're citizens or not, we just care whether they're here, i.e. in Britain. So we can enact laws on immigration that will stop people coming into the country. So how can we do that to citizens? Because citizens are all supposed to be treated equally. So then during the 50s, you have this sort of, people are assessing the feasibility of a migration bill and arguing for the need for migration control. But, and Hansen argues, and I'll quote this, that it would be impossible to justify a migration bill on purely economic grounds, as the committee had found no evidence that immigrants were an undue burden on national assistance. So in the same way as today, we have these debates about how migrants cost the taxpayer and add to the welfare budget and all this sort of stuff, whereas most economists would argue migrants add to the economy, not detract from it, and all these sorts of things. These are exactly the same debates happening in the 1950s. So there's no evidence that immigrants are an undue burden on national assistance, and so you can't make the economic argument against them. And then some within the cabinet had assumed that this bill wouldn't apply to the old Commonwealth countries. So the old Commonwealth countries are Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the settler colonies, i.e. the places of white Commonwealth citizens. And they had just assumed that it wouldn't apply to them, it would only apply to those of the darker Commonwealth countries. But how are you going to institute that in law? And remember, this is the post-war period. You've obviously had the Nazi period in Germany, where race and racist biology has been sort of created the catastrophe that occurred within Europe. And so politicians are sensitive about explicitly creating laws based upon race at this time. And so even if that's what they're trying to navigate, they won't say that directly. And so some people had assumed that it wouldn't apply to the old Commonwealth. Others, however, such as the colonial secretary, Alan Lennox Boyd, made it clear that he would find the exclusive application of immigration restrictions to colonial immigrants intolerable. So at this point, there are still politicians in cabinet who are committed to the post that they hold, and he was the colonial secretary responsible for the colonies, and he didn't wish the subjects for whom he was responsible to be discriminated against in the establishment of these laws, and he stops the bill going through at this point. By the 1960s, however, things begin to shift. So you begin to have increased movements of decolonization, particularly within Africa. These have consequences of generating a greater movement of people into Britain, in part as a consequence of the way in which some of the African countries negotiate their own citizenship laws. So Kenya and Uganda, begin to have Africanist policies which don't straightforwardly recognize the populations who'd come from India and had lived in these places as Kenyans or Ugandans, but they can't go to India because they're no longer Indian citizens, because India on independence had said that if you wish to be a citizen of India, you've got to be living and residing in India, but they still hold British passports. So then they try to come to Britain, and Britain says, no, you're refugees. And they're like, well, why are we refugees? We have British passports, we're British citizens. And Britain refuses to let them in. And so there's all this sort of stuff going on in terms of the consequences of decolonization. There is also what comes to be termed race riots within some of the major cities within Britain. So in London, in Nottingham, and so on. So these race riots weren't just people of different races fighting each other, it was where the white population particularly organized to attack minority populations. And that becomes something that gets into the national news and international news, and in coming into the international news, it sort of undermines Britain's reputation as this beacon of tolerance, equality, and so on. And so there are reasons why what had always been seen as a matter of international concern, issues of immigration, now becomes linked directly to issues of domestic concern. And so they try to start this process again of limiting immigration. Just as an aside, so this is the point, and in 62 and 68 they enact Immigration Acts, and in 71. So these are the three Commonwealth Immigration Acts, which effectively take citizenship away from darker citizens primarily and establish a form of citizenship on the basis of race and colonial status. But just to say something about the numbers. So again, you know, there's this incredible moral panic about these immigrants, about the fact that they're putting pressure on school places, they're putting pressure on housing, they're taking too much from welfare, all the same arguments that we have as the present. And the concern was directed almost entirely at what are called new Commonwealth immigrants. So this is the people who are visibly marked as different. Now, by 1961, where you've had movement of people for a while now, the foreign-born population of Britain was 5%. Out of the top 10 sending countries, i.e. the countries from which people came to come and settle in Britain, 8 were white, and only 2 were from the darker nations. This is out of the top 10 in terms of the numbers of people who came. There was close to 700,000 people from Ireland, were born in Ireland, living in Britain. There were 121,000 from Germany and 120,000 from Poland, just to take the top three white sending countries. The rest, the two that were not white, was 157,000 from India and 100,000 from Jamaica. So the constant concerns about coloured immigration, which is how it was termed at the time, the moral panics that are constantly being whipped up in relation to this, belie the fact that the total foreign-born population, the total white foreign-born population, the majority of whom who would have been migrants and aliens, because they're not straightforwardly coming from Commonwealth, apart from the Irish, the Poles and those from Germany and Italy and so on are not coming from the Commonwealth, so they are migrants. They were 10 times the size of the coloured population, the majority of whom would have been citizens and travelling legally within the circuits of empire. And so in a sense, it's interesting to think why, when sociologists in the present talk about multiculturalism and diversity, they talk only about those who look different rather than those who were actually migrants who come to Britain at that time and don't have the language, don't have citizenship, don't have rights, but nonetheless are assimilated into our understanding of who we are, whereas those who come often speaking English as citizens, holding British passports, are treated as other and seen to be unassimilable. So you have these immigration acts that come in. They basically restrict the movement of darker citizens. They enable those of the old Commonwealth to have continued access. This is the time when Britain establishes the patrial citizenship. If you can prove that you had a grandparent who was white British, then you would have access to Britain. That's how they get around the idea of allowing people from Australia and Canada to come back to Britain and Zimbabwe afterwards, and not people from other parts of the Commonwealth. And there's an Irish exemption to this act. So this is also interesting in terms of the current debates around Brexit, because Ireland, having been a colony of Britain, but then gaining its independence, has a complicated relationship with Britain where it doesn't wish to join the Commonwealth in 1948 because it doesn't wish to be part of a broader political entity with Britain. But because so many Irish people move back and forth between Ireland and Britain for work, an exemption is created, which is that we will treat Ireland as if it were a Commonwealth country, and we will treat the Irish as if they were Commonwealth citizens. So that's the legal status of the Irish in Britain. It's as if they were Commonwealth citizens and not that they are. And that is now under threat as a consequence of Brexit, because it's not clear whether the older laws that enabled free movement between Ireland and Britain will trump the new laws that will come into place where there'll need to be a hard border between EU countries and Britain. And so one of the major consequences of Brexit, and one of the least discussed, is what will happen to the border at Northern Ireland, particularly given that everybody in Northern Ireland is eligible for an Irish passport. And so do you create a hard border that divides citizens of one country overlapping and so on? And so that's really problematic. How much longer should I? A little bit. I mean, I just, in a sense, having set out the history that provides the basis for thinking about the debates, I guess I want to sort of wrap up in terms of thinking about issues of the left behind that I started with at the very beginning, because this idea of how we understand ourselves, so this idea of who we are, is absolutely organized in terms of the idea of the nation. So if you can demonstrate historical belonging to the nation, then you have rights in the present. But if, as I've been arguing, Britain was never a nation, it was an empire, then those who have rights in the present are a much greater population than exists within the imaginary, which locates that population only within the island of the UK. Now, why that's significant in terms of these debates is because this idea of the left behind and the way in which it gained absolute resonance relies on an acceptance that those who have this historical belonging to the nation are somehow more deserving than those who've come more recently, or who can't trace their sense of belonging simply to the nation, but are part of this broader imperial enterprise. Now, one could understand it in part as a political maneuver, you know, so Nigel Farage and the others, they talk about it as this was part of the political strategy of the time in order to make sure that Leave won and all these sorts of things. But the dangerous thing, in my eyes, is the fact that a lot of this discourse has been taken up by academics and those who are part of policy institutes and so on. So just very recently, last week indeed, there was an article or a report published by the Policy Exchange think tank, which is sort of titled "Racial Self-Interest is Not Racism," as a way of justifying the majoritarian resentment, or a majoritarian politics of resentment. And I think that It's dangerous in its own terms, but it's also based on inadequate history, because in a sense who it recognises as us isn't a multicultural us, which is what empire, how empire has constituted Britain, but simply at a particular racialised us. And as I was saying at the very beginning, that if we wanted to look at who the left behind were, it would have to include BME communities, because there's no way that you can talk about issues of inequalities within education, employment, access to jobs and so on, without recognising that those who are left behind are a multicultural left behind, not simply the white working class left behind. And so trying to think through, well, why this discourse specifically on the white working class? And what people are focusing on, sociologists as well as other academics, is this idea of a decline, that the white working class had, for a period of time, had good jobs, unionised jobs, access to social housing, access to benefits, and these sorts of things. And that over the past 20, 30 years, there's been a decline in the conditions within the white working class find themselves, and and nobody's been talking about this, and it's really important to focus on the decline in those conditions. Now, I think, yes, it is important to look at that decline, but it's also important to look at the fact that what that decline does is bring the white working class in common with BME communities who've always existed within the condition to which the white working class have now declined to. And what there seems to be less concern with is the fact that these conditions, which are conditions of precarity, of non-unionised work, limited access to social housing, were the conditions of much of the BME population prior. So what had gone on? In the 60s and 70s, as people came into Britain, there was in operation in Britain a racialised access to the labour market. So many of the good jobs, which would have been unionised jobs, you could only get access to those jobs if you're a member of the union. But the union maintained a racial bar and wouldn't allow people who weren't white to join the union. If you couldn't join the union, you couldn't get those jobs. So the BME community was forced into precarious, non-unionised, low-paid work, which was here. The unionised, well-paid pensions, etc., benefits, was here. Now that we've had 30 years of neoliberalism and more recently austerity, and there's been attack on the conditions of unions, attack on the conditions of employment and so on, what you've had is a decline of those jobs to come into a common situation with people who'd already been in these sorts of jobs previously. For me, the issue is that we ought not to have conditions in which people are doing precarious, non-unionised, low-paid work in these conditions, that nobody should be doing it. So it's not just the fact that the white working class are now doing it such that makes us concerned with this and need to address it. We should address it for everybody who's in that sort of position. And so there's a way in which our refusal to recognise the imperial context for the emergence of understandings of race and class makes us think of race and class as separated, as opposed to thinking about the ways in which class itself is racially formed out of these very processes. And in a sense, as I was saying, for politicians to argue this is one thing, but for academics to refuse to take into account the way in which a broader understanding of history would force us to think differently about what we understand as our national past, I think is unforgivable, particularly in the very dangerous times that we're living in and that we're seeing ahead of us. So I think I will leave it there, and happy to take questions and discussion in relation to this.
Thank you.
Sandy. Yeah, thank you so much. It was a very, very rich and interesting set of remarks. Keep this going in English for now, right?
Yeah.
So, it's unfair on you if you you might guess.
Yes, I could just walk out.
Yeah. Right, so, yes, so thank you very much for that. So, I mean, it sort of brought up a whole set of different reflections, and I actually want to start with a moment which is sort of present, interestingly, you know, in your account, the late 60s, early 70s, you know, around the time when, as you say, this whole question of what I would think of as this kind of push and pull you between Commonwealth and EU, which way to go, is happening. So just to remind you, sort of, one is more like an anecdote and one is a historiographical reflection. So I don't know whether many of you remember a very famous incident that took place in the early 1970s. The guitarist Eric Clapton was playing a concert in North England. And he was quite drunk, I think, but that's not the reason for it. He began haranguing the crowd about immigration. And he began saying that Britain was being overtaken by immigrants. And a very substantial altercation broke out. I think part of it is recorded, actually. And what is actually interesting, of course, let's bear two or three things in mind, right? One is that Eric Clapton made his career essentially taking black music and bringing it to a British audience. At the time that he was engaged in this argument, the biggest hit that he was about to produce was a song called I Shot the Sheriff, written by Bob Marley. But what he actually quoted was a very famous speech, which I'm sure you know very well, and that is the so-called Rivers of Blood speech. The Rivers of Blood speech, which was made by a conservative politician, but who's actually seen much more as a guru beyond the conservative party, a very intelligent and very dangerous man called Enoch Powell. Right? And he actually said that he saw a more or less eye to eye with Enoch Powell on this question. And I think that he was particularly thinking actually of West Indian immigration much more than South Asian. Immigration. So that's kind of a paradoxical thing where someone is making some sort of argument about lack of cultural permeability when he's playing black music. It's a very interesting sort of paradox, isn't it? So that's the anecdote. But let's remember this is also the moment, roughly in the late 60s, early 70s, when these kinds of questions were actually brought to the fore actually by the leftist theoreticians. As much as by anybody else, right? I had an occasion to think about it because I was just reading, the posthumously published memoir of Benedict Anderson, right? The famous historian and theorist of nationalism. So this is a book called A Life Beyond Boundaries. It's a very interesting book because he published it first in Japanese and eventually in English. And in this book, actually, Anderson, who's by the way, sociologically very interesting because he, as I came to know when I invited him once to India, still to the end of his life held an Irish passport. His brother, who's someone I know quite well, Ferry Anderson, holds a British passport, and calls himself Anglo-Irish. So already you can see the interesting tensions there. So Anderson actually says something very interesting, which is he says that his whole reflection on nationalism actually stems from this time and stems particularly from the interventions of Tom Nairn, right? The Scottish writer on nationalism, who was making an argument which is something you've referred to, which is to say an argument that Britain was an impossible project. It was artificially held together and it was going to fall apart, right? And it's an interesting reflection because of it has different consequences. It actually, to my mind, influences in a very curious way Perry Anderson's current position, which is actually in favor of Brexit. Right? So this is a left argument in favor of Brexit because of the idea that Europe is not democratic. Right? So that's one of the consequences coming out of Nairn. But the other thing, of course, which came out of Nairn was that I think that Nairn was the spiritual father of Linda Colley's book, Britons, which is a much more conservative reading of what the making of the artificiality, maybe not artificiality, but the political impetus which went into the making of the British nation. So it's also interesting to see how these critiques and positions are often coming from somewhat unexpected places, right? I mean, the very unself-conscious Clapton, who doesn't seem to understand the difference between his theory and his practice. And then someone like Nairn, who I think understands what he's doing, but I mean, I'm curious to know today then where would Nairn stand on something like the independence of Scotland, which is one of the consequences which very likely will be up for debate whether Terra Sydney likes it or not. So eventually, is one of the larger effects of Brexit going to be the breakup of Britain? It seems not unlikely. It seems a bit up for grabs, but it's an interesting question. Okay. Now, basically, I thought that the remarks that you made are helpful to us in a number of different ways. By the way, you may or may not be aware of the fact that there's been something of a publishing sensation in France in the last 3 months, which is a book called Histoire Mondiale de la France, or something like that. It's, I think, sold 80,000 copies, which no history book should reasonably do. It's edited by one of my colleagues in the College of France, Patrick Boucheron. It's a very strange book. It's been very heavily attacked by certain people who claim that it's sort of eating away at what really being French is about, and that it's too multicultural a version of what being French is. So in a way, it's sort of addressing the Brubaker idea in a very odd kind of angle. And of course, what is really curious about the book is the book has no content. It's a slogan, it's nothing else. Right? If you actually read the book, there's nothing in it. So you might as well just have put the two covers up there and left the pages blank for the book. So, but this is therefore something which is up, you know, it's in the air, it's not. So in a way, what Brexit is going to do is, I think, possibly also stimulate such discussions elsewhere, even in other European contexts which are not exactly the same, and certainly historically are not exactly the same. I think what you've really brought up for me, which is really which is interesting, is first of all the enormous importance of this very peculiar category of the Commonwealth, right? Which is I don't think easily replicable elsewhere in any other imperial context that one can think of. I think that what is also particularly interesting is this whole. Their process of showing how progressively things, you know, you start with a large, capacious category, and then historically, on every instance, you try to cut down, restrict. Sometimes in reaction to other people's nationalism. So it's a question of, so Idiomine's nationalism produces a new kind of British nationalism in a certain sense. So there's a kind of if you like, a kind of a connected history of nationalisms to be written, where it's not as if, as distinct from Brubaker's notion that there's a set of possible nationalisms, I think it's also interesting to see how nationalisms are co-produced. Right? It's impossible to imagine that nationalism exists in a vacuum, it exists in relation to another nationalism. In South Asia, we know this very well. I mean, Indian nationalism has a lot to do with Pakistani nationalism, and the other way around, we know that. But it's, I think, more difficult sometimes for people in Europe to admit that the nationalism itself is sort of co-produced. The sort of last set of remarks I want to make is you know, in relation to these to this whole very facile evocation which there's been also in recent times of the category of rage or anger as some kind of an explanatory category. I don't know whether you've actually seen this extremely strange book written by an Indian author called Pankaj Mishra called The Age of Anger, where he actually tries to make an equivalent between what he calls anger here and anger there. So it's as if the anger of Brexit and the anger of ISIS and the anger of white populations in the Appalachians is all somehow unified by the fact of its being anger, right? And it's a sort of popular theorization, which I think it's getting a lot of play. Fortunately, it's getting some pushback. Michael Ignatieff has a very interesting critique of it recently. But it's interesting to see how people are taking this and doing exactly what we would never do, which is to imagine that somehow an emotion is primitive. And therefore not socially produced, and therefore can be used as a kind of a ladder to move from one place to another without thinking about what actually whether Osama bin Laden's or as Zahavi's anger is the same thing as Donald Trump's anger, which would be worrisome if it were the case. So, I do think that what we have over here also is, in your exercise, is something which I think is extremely useful because of the fact that you've really stepped away from all of that, and I think what you've given us is a much more kind of nuanced account of all of this, which I think very rightly does stress this whole relationship between empire, commonwealth, and EU. The one question which actually I would ask you is this, and this takes me back to Nairn and Anderson and so on. Often when I read Anderson, I'm struck by the fact that perhaps subconsciously, I mean Perry Anderson, not Benedict Anderson, whether he actually has a reflex, a subconscious reflex, and whether this is actually a shared reflex, which is where the imperial imaginary is still alive. And therefore, whether in some sense in this whole evocation of what it is to belong to Europe, what is being suggested is that the imperial form, being the only form that really can exist as a large form, if Britain is not the center of that empire, then Britain must be the colony in that empire. Right? So therefore, seeing the EU as an imperial form, and seeing Britain, therefore, now the tables are turned, Britain has now become, the colonizer has become the colonized. And that therefore, this language of leaving is also, in some sense, a very curious borrowing, actually, of some sort of distorted version of the language of anti-colonial nationalism, which is, I think, actually effectively a failure of the imagination, because one imagines that the only sort of large political forms that exist are imperial forms. Well, that's a logical conclusion that one comes to. But did you actually find, for instance, in the language that was being used, there was that sort of an idea that not only does the empire sort of bite back or strike back, but that we are now, look how the mighty have fallen. We who were once the people who ruled the world, we are now the colonized of the bureaucrats of Brussels.
Yes, oh, thank you so much for those comments. I mean, absolutely, in terms of the last, because I think a lot of the resentment against the EU is precisely because this is the first time that Britain has been part of a broader political formation which it isn't leading. So it's the first time that it's been forced.
Since the 13th century, left 12th yes.
century, of course, also, for the within the modern period, I will qualify the remark. Within the modern, it's the and I think that is something that this is the first time that Britain has had to treat others as equals. And that's something that it cannot deal with. And in a sense, it's this sort of, that in part how I see what's playing out at the moment is almost as if it's the death throes of empire. That this is, for me, the ultimate breakup of Britain. And I think where Nairn, in his analysis, which he makes in the 70s, as interesting as it was, he doesn't really talk about empire or the Commonwealth at all in terms of thinking about the way in which Britain is constituted. And where I think Linda Colley has something to say is that it's only in empire that Britain comes to understand itself as Britain, because it's the thing that provides a unity or a sense of coherence or identity to that nation is Britain. Once you no longer have empire, what meaning does British have? British has no meaning. So the people who identify with being British citizens in Britain are more likely to be ethnic minorities from the former Commonwealth than straightforwardly white English, white Welsh, white Scottish. They have the white national identity, whereas the British was an imperial identity. And so those sorts of things come together. So if there is no empire, and now you don't have the mask of the European Union hiding the fact that you no longer have an empire, what do? You wish to reconstitute empire. So Theresa May, recently, you may have seen, went to India. She wore a sari and she sort of put a bindi on and decided that was sufficient to be able to argue in India that, well, what we want is access to your markets. And Modi says, yes, okay, you can have access to our markets. We want to send our young people to Britain. No. It's like, well, then you can't have access to our markets. But it was almost as if she thought simply wearing the sari would enable her to get access to those markets without giving anything else. And the policy that's being presented by British bureaucrats is called Empire 2.0. You know, that's how it's unofficially known, Empire 2.0, as if somehow this time we'll go and be, I don't know, a friendly empire. Or and you just think, what have you not understood about the way in which the world has sort of changed, such that this is just not possible? So there's a strange, and I think that this is correct, that the post-war period, particularly the fact of winning the World War and then entering Europe, has meant that Britain hasn't had to consider what the end of empire and decolonization has meant for it. And now suddenly it's seeking to exit Europe. It doesn't have the relationships with Commonwealth that it believed that it did. And it's going to be, and I think it's actually, it's potentially going to be a very dangerous decade that's looming ahead of us, because I can't understand how the different aspects are going to be reconciled. There was a poll done recently about, you know, what do you think is the most important thing that we should get out of Brexit? Free movement, access to the single market, and so on. 82% wanted access to the single market without freedom of movement. And you think, well, those two are incompatible. It's just not possible. So what, and when, having taken back sovereignty, when life doesn't get better, who's going to be at fault? Who's going to be there to be blamed? Well, you've already had the scapegoats begun to be set up in the discourse of Brexit, which is migrants and anybody who looks different. That's going to be the populations that are going to be most at risk. So I think it's an incredibly dangerous moment in Britain, precisely for the sort of response. And I think the left position of people like Perry Anderson, I mean, it's as if they're stuck in the 1970s and their critique of the EU is the critique they made in the 70s, and they don't understand. I mean, I've been not the greatest fan of the EU, and I write critically on the EU, but I also understand that a Britain outside of the EU is a much worse prospect than a Britain inside the EU, because at least for us in Britain, all progressive legislation in Britain in relation to employment and so on comes from Europe. And in fact, it's Britain that's been the neoliberal brake on the development of social policies within Europe. So you may be better off without us, you know, being part of this entity, but we'll certainly be worse off. And there's this, so it's just, it's a complete mess, basically.
Yeah, okay, well, thanks ever so much.